This is Sarah Robinson with Conscious Creating. Today I'll be talking with world-renowned artist scholar Lydia Rule, a recognized authority on goddess mythology. She is a beloved speaker, teacher, and travel guide, and the author of Goddess Icons, Spirit Banners of the Divine Feminine.
Lydia Rule, welcome to Conscious Creating. You're having an exciting week, aren't you?
I am. I'm in the middle of Camp Yaya.
Camp Yaya, what's that?
Well, Camp Yaya is grandmother's camp. I am a grandmother of six, and my three children grew up next door to their grandparents, but they have moved across the United States. So I have a son in Denver, a daughter in Chicago, and a daughter in Philadelphia. And the six grandchildren are all within 5 years of each other, five girls and one boy. And I have them come in the summer when the schedules can possibly get worked out, and that's complicated, to spend a week with me and without their parents, so that they can have grandmother time and grandfather. They have Grandpa Bob here, too. And it's a wonderful relationship. I absolutely love it. I love my own children, but when they're not around, their children have a very different reaction to me. Four of them are here right now.
How old are they?
Eight, nine, another nine who's soon to be 10, and a 13-year-old, and they're all little girls.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yes, it's wonderful.
Really exciting. And you do have a grandson as well, don't you?
I have one grandson. He lives in Denver, and we saw him last night. The other reason they're all here is that many of us are Leos, so we're celebrating six family birthdays.
And your birthday is this week, is it not?
My birthday is Friday. My son was born on my birthday. My granddaughter was the 30th of July, another daughter the 15th of August, and another granddaughter, the 27th of August. So we have a pile of these. And then I have an aunt. And my husband's grandmother, who lived to be 109.
109.
Our third. So we used to have many multi-generational birthdays. Now we're down to just three. But we did have five going for a while.
Well, you and I share this in common. My birthday is August 12th.
Oh, my.
Which is 1 month after my younger daughter, July 12th, and then my other daughter, the one that will be 17, is August 25th. My wedding anniversary, it'll be 24 years, is August 28th. And then my mother-in-law's birthday is August 31st. My father's birthday was September 1st. My father-in-law's birthday is September 5th. So we are just all right.
Right.
I go broke this time of the year.
Well, we often have laughed about it, but there's some real strong personalities in the Leo frame.
that was my next question. What is that like, having these little Leos? And tell the audience a little bit about Leos. Who are Leos?
Leos like to lead, and they're lions, and they're used to being in the limelight often. So when you have many of them, you have to negotiate. And you really don't know what the outcome is going to be, particularly within the family situation. Although often, because I'm the matriarch, they will say, well, what is it that you want to do? And then they'll usually agree. But I always like input, so I don't do it from an authoritarian point of view.
You just described yourself as a matriarch. How does that feel?
Well, how does that feel? It's life gives you all these lessons, and at 71 on Friday, I'm the oldest of my parents' relationship, and when they died, I then became the the oldest of their progeny, and they had 3 living children, 9 living grandchildren, and now, as of 2 weeks ago, they would have had 17 great grandchildren. Actually, 13 girls and 4 boys. So I am the oldest of all of those 39 offspring. I inherited it. I wasn't ready for it necessarily, and I was very shocked. And one of my dear friends said, "Well, you've always been an MIT." And I said, "What? MIT, what is that?" And she said, "Matriarch in training."
And she knew you. She knew you well enough to know what that is. And even on your website, you describe yourself as a crone.
Well, I am. Anyone over 60 is considered a crone, sometimes even over 50. And it's the older woman. I think that's a self, or it's a term that older women have embraced. Over time, there have been many names for older women, hag being one. And even witch came from Wicca, wise woman in the English language. And often more depicted elderly or old. I'm seeing in early art, in Neolithic art, because that's what I've been studying recently, that the older women were the more ample figures. And when you think about what it takes to survive, you want a certain amount of ampleness in food. And so those who represented that were made into figurines, like the Venus of Willendorf.
The Venus of Willendorf. I was just thinking that. Now, you had a strong matriarch in your own life growing up, didn't you?
Right. My mother was a very strong matriarch, although she was the middle child of a family of 10. Both my parents, both of their grandparents immigrated from Russia. After immigrating from Germany with Catherine the Great around 1769. Catherine was German. She married a Russian who became the Tsar, and she became the Tsarina, and then she ruled for almost 50 years. And she invited the Germans to come and try to farm the Volga and make it more like her homeland of Germany, which they did. And they were given special privileges, including not serving in the Russian army. Well, towards the end of the 19th century, they started conscripting the men into the armies, and so they began leaving in droves and came to the U.S., and that's what my ancestors on both sides did. So I had some aunts and uncles born in Russia and some born here. And they were the immigrant labor. They became the immigrant farm laborers. But hardworking, and soon were owning the farm. And we live on the land that my Olive grandparents purchased in 1918. And it's still in the city of Greeley. And
Greeley, Colorado.
Farm for a while, and then it was the first subdivision. Really, and I grew up farming it as well as going to school.
Oh, really?
And so I have this kind of bridge perspective between a culture that was very, very different than what it is today.
And who was Muti?
Muti was my mother, and her name was Lydia Alles, A-L-L-E-S, Miller, and this is called Alles Acres after the family farm.
And you describe her in your book, Goddess Icons, Spirit Banners of the Divine Feminine, as being a feminist, an early feminist, and a political activist.
She was.
How did that influence
you? Somehow, one of her sisters has told me that her mother did not want her to go on to college, which is right next door to us. She had to do all her farm chores, but she went anyway. And it's her father that said she could go. Both my grandmothers could not read or write. They had to sign their names with X's. So this would have been an uneducated mother who didn't see any reason for a college education, but my mother was determined to acquire it, which she did. She was a linguist and could do six languages. Well, she just kind of was one of those who went out and did her thing. She graduated from UNC in 1929, and she ended up in Casa Grande, Arizona, on the Indian reservation, teaching. And 5 years later, she married my father. And then she began, as a young mother, to get involved in all kinds of various activities. She helped found the American Association of University Women chapter here because she was proud to graduate from college. She actually helped start the Girl Scouts in the community. And then in 1944, during the Second World War, she ran for the state legislature.
That's amazing to me.
Which is pretty amazing. She was beaten. She's a Democrat, and I'm a Democrat, and this area of Colorado is very conservative. The only ones more conservative are Colorado Springs. So Democrats very rarely win. In fact, the county has gone Democratic only twice, once with Roosevelt and once with LBJ.
And so as Muti's eldest daughter, it was natural that you would be encouraged to pursue an education. And
right.
You received...
Well, there was never any question. And my father's also a lawyer, and his family of 10, 7 of them were educated, actually. Only 3 in my mother's were, beyond high school. And some of my mother's family didn't even graduate from high school. So, but my grandfather Miller, on my father's side, was an educated man in Russia. So he was able to read and write in several languages, and he became the bridge between writing home to Russia and translating, and also being able to do it in German and then in English.
So
I came from 2 parents with college degrees who wanted all their children to have college degrees, and they all do. In fact, I'm an artist. My sister's a medical doctor. She was only 2 women in her class in 1962 when she graduated from the University of Colorado Medicine. And my brother's actually a federal judge in Denver. With degrees from the University of Chicago and the University of Freiburg in Germany.
Well,
we ended up doing lots of higher ed.
Well, I would say that being the matriarch of that family is quite a privilege.
Well, it is. It is. I see it as, I take it seriously. I want to encourage all the girls, because we have so many, to know that they can do anything that they choose, but they have to protect that right to choose. It isn't always a given.
Well, that's absolutely correct, yeah.
You inherit your views. You inherit a programming from your parents. You inherit two, paternal and maternal. And when you get, hopefully, to the college level, you can experience different stories or different myths, different programmings, and then you'll understand your own better. You never can get your own until you've been exposed to something else.
There were 10 of you at that walk from your family.
Right.
Multi-generational representation.
Well, 3, again. My sister, the medical doctor, her daughter, 2 of my daughters, 4 of my granddaughters, and 1 brave grandson, or 1 son-in-law.
Is that what it was? Yeah.
Was the site, yeah.
All right. So you received your BA from the University of Colorado at Boulder in political science and economics, and then went on to earn an MA at the University of Northern Colorado, UNC, at Greeley, where you live now, and married Bob, your longtime partner.
Right.
How many years have you and Bob been married?
It will be 49 this year.
I bow to you. That's wonderful.
It's a long time. We actually met in kindergarten, however. So
did you really?
We've known each other over 65 years.
Oh, that is just wonderful.
Yeah.
So you really are part of each other.
Very much so. Very much so. And he's been very supportive of my all of my endeavors and my journeys. It isn't always easy, and I have to really decide to choose. When I, but he knows when I have chosen a path that probably the best role is to just cheer me on.
I have a man like that in my life, and we're about to celebrate 24 years, and God bless people that marry people like us, Liddy.
Right, I agree. It's that one of my son-in-laws, we have two daughters, and he's had interesting time supporting them, too, on their individual journeys, and now, of course, the five granddaughters coming up. But at the second daughter's wedding, they all three of our children got married within 11 months. And at the second daughter's wedding, the first son-in-law stood up, and he said, I want to make a toast to the rural women and the men who have to live with them, or choose to live with them.
That's terrific. That's terrific.
So far, those marriages are going on almost 20 years. This is 87.
I think there's a misconception among non-feminists or people just observing the work of feminists, observing the work of people interested in the divine feminine and goddess mythology, and that is that we're somehow either lesbians or don't like men or really prefer the company of women and men are just a compromise, and that simply is not true. And would you clarify some of that for our listening audience?
Well, because of what I do, I've gotten that for a very, very long time. And there's something about a woman who knows her own mind and makes her own choices that can be threatening. And I have found, though, that if I just go ahead and do what I'm here to do, that even very traditional people are very supportive of it, even though they probably wouldn't do what I do. And I think unless you just, there is really no way to, when someone has framed feminism from a negative standpoint, I don't think you can change that frame except by another example. And I've lived through the demonization of feminism. Because you see, I was I am a feminist. I don't think it's a nasty word. But most of the college women today don't want to be called feminists. And that because it was demonized.
Is it womanist? That's a new, relatively new word.
Well, yes. Or supporter of women's rights. Or to me, it's a matter of equality more than anything. And women have a right to choose how they're going to live their lives and what they do with their bodies and what they contribute to the world. And men and women should have that equal choice, period.
And I want to make sure it's understood that I'm not suggesting that people who are lesbians, who are feminist and interested in the divine feminine, that that's a negative thing. It is not. It's just that we're all sorts of people.
That's true. Very true. Very true. And I have particularly in my classes and on my sacred journeys have a wide range of women from all walks of life and men. Men actually sign up for the goddess classes.
My father, who was born in 1918 and really probably should have been my grandfather technically, was one of the first card-carrying members of National Organization for Women.
Good for him.
And he you may have known him, Bill Robinson. He was a political activist and civil rights leader.
Uh-huh.
He said, "Don't judge me by the shape or age of my skin." And I loved that.
That's very wonderful. And don't judge a woman by what you think she is. Why did you ask her what she thinks she is?
Well, and people would ask Dad why he would join the National Organization for Women back in the 1960s and why he did that. He said, "I have a daughter."
Right.
"And I love women."
Or a granddaughter. Not wanting women to have the equal choices that men have and be treated with equal pay and everything else. I can't understand that lack of awareness.
It's very difficult for people who have our sensibility to understand that, and yet culturally it's just been pervasive in Western culture.
That's true. Yeah, but culture, of course, is taught by the live people in it. And unless you question some of the what you've inherited, I tell my students they've gotten a program disc from the mother's side of the family and the father's side of the family. It goes into their computer, you know, just like you put the disc in. And that's what you have to have. That's what you have to grow up with. And if you've got a certain flavor of religion with that, that's what you're going to be exposed to. If you've got no religion, you still have that kind of a programming of no religion. And only when you can get to a place where you can hear and experience someone from a different background, from a different religion, from a different culture, can you understand your own.
And I might add, I like this metaphor or analogy of a program disc. I wonder if we get a tribal disc, too. A disc
yes.
that contains, I mean, Joseph Campbell talked about that, a disc that contains the mythology of our particular tribe in a given place and time.
Yes, we do. We do. And then the tribe, the larger tribe, becomes the nation. And to become aware of the mythologies of the world and what the belief systems then become in daily life is a big step to take.
I'm interested in the role that highly creative people play in our society, and that's why we're doing this show. And would you say that highly creative people certainly are or perhaps a little more sensitive than other people, and not special, but just we pick up on more comes
well,
our way.
Well, I think everyone has gifts.
And I'm wondering if you would, I mean, what role do we have in guiding transformation, in moving the culture forward away from negative kinds of programming?
One, I think if you, and I've had Joseph Campbell calls it the call.
Right.
If you get the call and things in your life don't work over time, and you finally say, "What is this about? How come I keep running into this blank wall? Is there something else that I can do?" And I didn't realize or consciously choose art until I was taking care of five small children under the ages of 18 months. And I say that choice changed my life drastically.
Did it?
Because, one, it helped me, and it helped them. And that painting is bright red and has a lot of anger in it. But at that point, I felt like, you know, I was beside myself. And once I chose that path, then as I went down it, the universe gave me many gifted teachers. When you're ready to hear what's out there to teach, they come to you. And Joseph Campbell was one of them. He gave me a language for how I could see in art that the mythic stories have been told. And that then meant I had to go to the religions to find out how the religions use the art to tell their stories. And I began to see that women's stories weren't told at all. There were no artists in the art history books. This was 1980. And I said, I'm going to go find them. And I worked with Judy Chicago on the dinner, on the birth project, not the dinner party. And as a visionary, she unleashed a large number of women who were educated, aware, feminists, and they went out to try to find women's story, and that's what they've done, and have changed really how that story is told in higher education, particularly in the arts. It's a bit slower in some of the fields.
One of the things I find most exciting about your work, personally and intellectually and personally, emotionally, is you make a lot of what Campbell wrote about in Jung accessible to me as a woman, because you're using feminine pronouns. And I'm not suggesting that, I know Campbell cared very much about women, but he used a lot of masculine pronouns.
That's true. And he actually said, I think Maria Gimbutas wrote the introduction to his last book, and he said if he had found her work earlier, he would have looked through his lenses at the feminine differently. I know from my own life experience that it's up to women to tell the story from their feminine. And as it's told by women, men will then get it. But they can't tell the story of what it's like to be a woman. Your physical body and how you were treated culturally and in every way, form of your existence is different in male and a female.
Well, and you developed a course called Her Story of the Goddess, which you teach at UNC and Greeley. How did this come about?
Well, one, I'm teaching art history. There are no women artists. I decide to go find them. I have slides made. I find their stories. I start teaching about them. And the other faculty gets some of the story. And finally, the chair said, well, do you want to do a course? And I said, we'd love to. And there were other, a group of women faculty members got together outside of the university to just meet together as artists and talk about how we were being treated and how art and women in art had a different path than men. The chair asked if we wanted to develop a course, so we said yes, but the first title of it was Women in Art. And then because once we got into it, and got into Maria Gimbutas' work and others, Eleanor Gaydon, Monica Hsu, Abraham Eisler, and Anne Baring and Jules Cashford, whose book, The Myth of the Goddess, I think is the best background on the goddess concept from many points of view, philosophy, psychology, art history, religion. And that's my favorite text to teach from. But the course then evolved as we taught from each of those books. And eventually, I used Leonard Swain's the Alphabet versus the Goddess one year. The men in the class liked that book. The women did not. So I realized that it's very important in all forms to learn. And you can learn by reading, you can learn by doing, you can learn by listening, you can learn by traveling, and that's what I encourage women to do, to learn their story.
You know, I'd really like to talk about your art. It's colorful, layered, multidimensional, and it has sort of, for me, an earthy, homespun quality about it. So in addition to your roles of wife and mother and grandmother, you've enjoyed notable experiences in community service, like politics and teaching and world travel and the arts. And so I started thinking about how your art and your artistic style very much reflects the totality of who you are and what your interests have been. You are a multidimensional, layered, colorful individual. I find that fascinating.
Well, art is a mirror. And it really is, if you are doing it, one, you have to do it, not just talk about it. Although talking is also an art form, I don't want to say that that isn't. As is writing or whatever form it is that you choose, if you do it over time, it has to reflect your version of your reality in your body and place and culture, etc. And it also is really a reflection of your soul. It's that essence that can't be really embodied totally. It has to be expressed, and that's what the arts are about. The arts are about a soul language, and that's why we can study that over time. Hundreds of thousands of years, almost a million, they found some stones placed in the Sinai Peninsula that are in a ritual circle that are a million years old, so that humans have to do this. They have done it in caves, they've done it in clay, they've done it on canvas, they've done it in magnificent forms of architecture. But the energy it takes to create those places, to haul those stones for Stonehenge, hundreds of miles, and erect them, took a lot of energy. In human energy and some kind of a focus that was meaningful to a culture that did that. And usually it's about some kind of soul mystery, the mystery of the universe, why we're here, and how we want to continue our lines being here. So that our children and grandchildren, et cetera, will continue to be. So some way we want to help the universe, we think we're helping by erecting something or doing something that honors that spiritual essence.
And Phil Cousineau said, when I asked him why people create art, he said, because we want to leave a mark on the cave wall.
Yeah, right. I think humans have to do that. They have to. That's how they know they've been there, or that they are here. I've studied a lot of rock art, particularly in the Southwest, just it's what's available from earlier cultures here, and then have looked at it in the context of the rock art of the world, and it's phenomenal how similar the mark-making patterns are. And now neuroscience is recording those patterns in the brain connections, in the synapses of the brain.
Yes, I read something recently about a scholar, I don't recall his name, he's probably quite famous, who has been studying cave markings for a long time, and now we're beginning to see that some of these cave markings are reflective of mystical or heightened mystical states in the brain.
That's right. And they've connected, there are a couple of them, but David Lewis Williams from South Africa.
Okay, that's who it was, yes.
Is one of the really fascinating ones.
Fascinating.
And Jean-Claude of France. But David Lewis Williams has, I'm really fascinated with him because he's now connected some of his findings with my interest in Turkey at a Neolithic site called Şatalhöyük and the pattern making that happened there and the ritual, the construction of the community, which was kind of like the Pueblo in layers where they went down into the buildings from the rooftops. He believes it was all a mythical experience of altered state consciousness. And he connects it again to his research around the world. And there are many others doing this. It's a really exciting new field, actually. And because of my interest in mark making and art and symbolism, I just am, it's really exciting.
Our friend Mary Carol Nelson says of your work, she has a recognizable style, one involving clear and accentuated lines, rich colors, a defined compositional quality that mixes pattern with solid color, and a solemnity of presentation that resembles the directness of folk art. The work I've seen by you, Lydia, does seem to have a very distinct style, and I'm interested in knowing if this was something that just sort of showed up for you, or if you, in fact, developed the style over a period of years.
I think it developed over the period of years because, one, I was studying the art of the world, teaching it, seeking the divine feminine in it, and when I found it, I was then able to frame it from my own life experience. One, I love color and always did, but I went through a period where all my art was black and brown, about 5 years in the early 80s.
That's surprising to me.
I know, but when I went back and looked over time, that was the period where I... my three children had left the nest. It was an empty nest. And I had, I was in transition. And I was ready for a new teachers and a new path.
You were also an MIT still, right? Your
right.
mother was living.
Right.
Right.
And so that's when the goddess showed up and became the icon for the path. And one of the first icons I made was of my great-great-great-grandmother. I had been doing all kinds of abstract work, and they had an iconic quality to them as well. But all of a sudden, I was drawn to do something figurative. So I do my great-grandmother sitting on the steps of Russia. And then from that pattern, I then developed a way of framing an image of the divine feminine, which I found in all the every culture of the world has an image. Some are easier to find than others, and very few of them did I ever find in art history. But once I began looking, often they found me.
That's interesting.
And then because of my awareness of that of images and of the divine feminine, the goddess, then I would take the image and put it in a cultural context. For instance, in my banners, I'd go back to the textile traditions or the architectural traditions or the shrine making traditions or whatever, and then surround the central image with patterns and design that relates to that culture. But I naturally kind of just pick the coloration that the culture gives me. For instance, I just did some for Hungary, And in the arts, their art, there's a real strong tradition of red and black and gold. And I did another banner this year for a conference in Bulgaria on sacred dance. And their folk tradition there, their pattern making is red, black, and white. And so that's what that banner had to become, a dancer from a cave wall dancing, and the background is a rug pattern that was called Gypsy Women.
I want to make sure our listeners understand that we're talking about spirit banners that Lydia made and has been making for many years now of the divine feminine. They're goddess icons. You have a book on this subject showing all of these beautiful banners. And maybe you'd like to give a little backstory about how these came about.
I'd love to, because, again, it's one of those lessons that came my way that I had to creatively resolve. In 1990, my neighbor, who's an orthopedic surgeon, brought me a flyer. And he had hired a man. My neighbor liked to sail. He grew up in Texas, and south of Texas. So he went sailing in the Aegean, and he hired a guide when he was in Turkey. Well, he hired a man by the name of Rashid Ergener, who was an economics professor at Bosphorus University, graduate from Oxford and Yale. And he had written a book, Anatolia, Land of the Mother Goddess. And he was going to give a tour of Anatolia, which is present-day Turkey. And my neighbor said, Lydia, this looks like your department, not mine. 6 months later, I show up in Istanbul, Turkey, and follow the trail of the mother goddess that Rashid Ergener had written about in his book. I met a wonderful woman on the trip from England. Her name was Asphodel Long. And she was a theologian, T-H-E-A-L-O-T-I-C-H. And she had studied the original text of the Bible in Aramaic, Greek, and Latin, and rode in a chariot drawn by lions, and had been teaching about the divine feminine in England. She was a contemporary of Maria Gimbutas. Rashid and I continued to communicate back and forth, and he wanted me to teach at Bosphorus University in Istanbul, and I agreed to do so, and then my mother died, and so we postponed it a year, and then my father died. So I was dealing with other issues in my life, and I was not able to go and teach. But he came as an exchange scholar to the university here in Greeley for a month, did research, and actually taught my goddess class and an economics class and other things as a visiting scholar. Well, he kept saying, Lydia, are you coming back to Turkey to teach? And I said, well, I'll come if you can find me some exhibitions, because by then I was doing art with Turkish goddess images in them. So he did. He got me an exhibition at the Women's Library in Istanbul. And the second one, and at the ancient site, Roman site of Ephesus, the Celsus Library, built in the second century, has walls, but it has no roof. And Ephesus has a fabulous museum. And it's in history one of the major ancient sites of the world, and then came into Christianity with Paul and Mary being made Mother of God there.
Isn't this also where some of the best ruins of the Roman Empire are? Actually,
yes.
In Turkey, right.
Actually, Turkey has better Greek and Roman ruins than any place in the Mediterranean. And they've discovered that treasure. Yes. This is 1990, and Turkey has not yet discovered as much about its ancient sites. Rashid has taken us to them, and there are very few people there. They're not very well improved. Well, it's a great difference today, 2006, because I've just returned from there. There's a vast tourism business going on. And what's really exciting to me is it's Turks who are going to see their ancient sites. sites.
Interesting.
They're the majority of the people there, and the Europeans. There aren't very many Americans there, which is fascinating to have them seeking their own stories and history beyond the one they're born into today. So Rashid arranges for these exhibitions, and then the Turkish government has an economics crisis, and they say no foreigners can be hired or paid in Turkey. And so, one, I don't teach, but I have the exhibitions. And the one in Istanbul at the Women's Library was in April, and my work was printmaking, and it needs to be framed and crated, and it's a physical transportation issue and hanging, et cetera. So I knew that I had to figure out something for the exhibition at Ephesus, which was being July, so I flew down and talked to the director of the museum, and the roof of this library is open to the sky, and
hmm.
to hang for a month outside in the sun and the wind, and I knew that that wouldn't work. So I asked him how we could protect them or frame them or whatever, and I could see that we weren't communicating. He said, this is the Ephesus Museum, we can do anything. And I said, well, but are you going to build plastic boxes around these pieces?
Right.
And we weren't communicating. So I said, I have to figure something else out. So on my flight back, I decided I needed to make flags. They had to be some kind of material that could hang out of doors. I had made banners and flags for Chautauquas and arts picnics. And the university where I teach for their 100th birthday. And so I'll just have to put these images on flags that can hang out. So I called companies, art supply companies, fabric companies, and said, how can I get these images put on fabric? So I was told, you can't. You can't paint there. We don't have any paint that holds on nylon. And I said, well, I've got to have something. So I began experimenting, you know, creatively. I had a student who could do heat transfers for T-shirts. And
mm-hmm.
I said, let's see if we can heat transfer under nylon. Lo and behold, we could.
Mm.
I was talking to the cultural affairs director saying, I need somebody to help me sew these banners. My sewing machine quit on my last banner project. And I can't do this all. She said, oh, we just had this great person do banners for the Civic Center. I called her. I found out we'd had children together in preschool. And she said, yes, she could sew for me. And then I went to Michael's and the craft places, and I bought T-shirt and craft paint. And I said, we're going to paint with this stuff, see how it works. So we did all this in 6 weeks, and I had 18 banners that hung at Ephesus for the month of July with goddess images from Turkey.
And what do you affectionately call your banners?
I affectionately call them my girls.
So you travel with the girls.
I mean that as an term of endearment because I have had a lot of girls to keep track of in my life. I still have a lot of girls to keep track of. And they behave a lot like my girls. They have their own stories. Sometimes they get quite independent, don't come home when they're supposed to, and cause their mother all kinds of worries. Three now. They found one that was lost in England for a year. They just found her. They emailed me. But only three have permanently never come home. One from Machu Picchu in Peru, one from San Francisco, and one from Germany.
Well, I'm going to San Francisco in a little while, and if I see it hanging in someone's loft, I'll...
Okay, it's one of my Black Madonnas.
I'll take her with me.
so that exhibition then began this whole process of making, this is 1995, goddess icon banners, because from that exhibition in Turkey, the Turkish delegation to the UN Conference on Women took my banners to Wairoz, was Beijing, but they ended up in Wairoz, China, in 1995.
Interesting.
And people saw them hanging there. They saw them hanging in, at Ephesus. And so requests came in. Can they hang in Russia? Can we hang them in Malta? And they have been traveling, circling the globe ever since. The 18 have become 205. And they represent most of the cultures of the world and probably 50 countries.
And the traditional icons, religious icons that the iconoclasts tried to get rid of, were more literal, and yet my feeling is that yours are symbolic and mythic.
Yes, I definitely appreciate that feeling on your part. What I'm trying to do is, what I do is find the image that culturally says divine feminine in that culture. And although we have no clue, I trust it being shown to me now, however it shows up. And for instance, if I need one for this Bulgarian dance, I asked Joan Marler, who's doing the journey, to point me to some images, and then she does, and I pick one that I think really speaks to me. And then when it shows up in the culture, you can't believe the response. I mean, this is our Black Madonna. This is our Pachamama. This is our Kuan Yin on her sacred island in China. They can't see the Roman Magna Mater as their image, but they certainly can see the Chinese one.
So they're claiming these individual goddesses as their own.
When it's their cultural image, they get it.
Hmm.
And then when I show them multi-cultural images, the connection starts to click.
Women and men?
Yes, women and men. Actually, I've had some interesting experiences with men. The banners were hanging. And this, I won't go into the long story of where and how they got there, but they were hanging on a golf course where, at a halfway house, and they were like stained glass windows. And so most of the golfers paid no attention to whether there was anything up there or not. But several did, and they, again, identified from their own background whether it was an image of the Virgin Mary or a man who had funded research on Mayan digs, recognized the Mayan, and then were very excited to tell me that they recognized it. And they've been very supportive. This is a very traditional golf club in Palm Springs, California.
This is Sarah Robinson with Conscious Creating, and I'm talking with artist scholar Lydia Rule, who is author of Goddess Icons, Spirit Banners of the Divine Feminine.
You have said in your book, and I want to share this quote with our listeners, your book, Goddess Icons, you describe beautifully how these banners or how icons can make connections. When you say, life is about connections between humans, the world of nature and the world of the spirit. Icons connect to the deep soul expression of the divine mystery of life. Each image was created and revered at some time in human history. I love that.
And that's definitely the essence of what I've learned. And the visual image speaks with the no words. There's just a connection that happens. It's beautiful to watch. And when I actually work with the images, I get into a different place.
In 1993, you started a company called Goddess Tours and began leading pilgrimages to sites of the sacred feminine around the globe. We've called these tours soul journeys. What do you mean by this?
There are sites all over the globe where rulers and religions have built magnificent temples, towers, stone formations, buildings, whatever. And they do exude for me special energies. And I get that response from many others. There where the mythic stories are told in the art and architecture of the world. There's no substitute for actually being in the place where this magnificent form was created in response to the earth energies that are there, the natural landscape, the gorgeous view, whatever. There's a reason for Chartres Cathedral to be where it is, or Stonehenge to be in the middle of England. So in that, my own traveling, I recognized my response, and I wanted to have other women have that response. And part of it started on my trip in Turkey with this woman from England, Asphodel Long. So she said we should do something like this in England. But she was 10 years older than I, and she said she couldn't do it, but I could. And so I found another woman who was interested, and we started Goddess Tours. The first one was to England, Wales, and Cornwall. And we've just finished one in Turkey. They've evolved through time from Goddess Tours to Yaya Journeys. And I've retired from actually logistically putting them all together when I was 65. But I have a niece who's traveled with me on the journeys, and her business is conferences. And so she agreed 2 years ago to do conferences in Turkey, and then added Rome, Paris, and Prague. For stations in Rome and Florence, my friend and other fellow artist, Meinrad Craighead, has joined me. In Turkey, we had other goddess scholars that I knew from all of my travels and connections, both Turkish women and U.S. women. And last year we had a woman from New Zealand, and this year we had a woman from Germany. So they have many teachers experiencing the sacred where it is in the world. And it's a magical journey.
Well, if you ever need anyone to carry your luggage, I'm available. Lydia Rule, thank you for joining me on Conscious Creating. This has been a sheer delight, and I hope you'll come back often.
I would love to, and good luck getting Conscious Creating out in the world.
To learn more about Lydia and her work, visit her website at lydiarule.com. Thank you for joining us on Conscious Creating. We invite you to visit our website at consciouscreating.net to give us your feedback, and visit our store where you will find books and CDs and DVDs of our guests. Music for today's show is from Chakra Suite by Stephen Halpern and is used here with permission. Sound engineering is provided by Billy Fallon with Out of Sync Productions. This is Sarah Robinson, host and executive producer, wishing you a fruitful week of conscious creating.